Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler with a quick tip today, and the tip is to ask. You know, by the time our kids get to be teens or 20-somethings, we think we know them so well that we stop asking them what they think about things or what they want. Or we don't ask about their memories of their life because we were there when it happened. So we just think we know. So this week, the tip is ask your child. Ask them what they're thinking about something. Ask them about their favorite memory, when they were most scared in their life, what the most exciting thing is that's happened to them in their life. Anything like that. Any kind of a probing question. And one, you're likely to learn something about your child that you didn't know. Just their thought processes or the way they see things, something will come to you. And two, they'll feel valued when you ask that and then you sit back and just listen to what they have to say. So that's the quick tip. I also want to give a big shout out and a huge thank you to you for supporting the podcast, inviting people to listen, or join the Facebook group, or visit mightyparenting.com, leaving a review, sharing on social media posts, and of course, financially supporting the podcast are all so very much appreciated. So thank you. And today, we are talking about our children's future happiness. As parents, you know, we do our best day to day to raise them. And then the day comes where maybe they hit their senior year of high school, or they're ready to start a job and move out of our house. And we realize that we still have more things we want to say to them. We still have more advice we want to give. But it's not something that we can really be doing as much as we would want at that point. I know I'm in that boat right now. My girls are in that phase where they're completing college courses and internships. They're working away from home for summers or terms. So they're moving in and out of our house a lot. And during this phase, I've really noticed that. I see so many things that I want to remind them of, new things I want to teach them, or new ways I want them to apply an old lesson that Tom and I have taught them. And so today, we have a guest who is going to help us through this. She is so aware of this urge of a parent to want to continue supporting and helping and guiding our children. She is Lisa Shumate, and she has more than 20 years of media management experience, including serving as executive director of the Houston Public Media Foundation, holding national leadership roles with PBS and the Public Television Major Marketing Group Board, and more. But now Lisa is expanding her media footprint to publishing with the goal of sharing wisdom and encouragement with young men and women entering adulthood. And this is where she helps us. She has authored Always and Never, 20 Truths for a Happy Heart. And she's joining us today to share wisdom and key concepts that we can share with our children, whatever their age. Lisa, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us in the Mighty Parenting community today.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
I really enjoyed your book, and it's not really just a book, because there are actually two. There's the Always and Never book, and then there's the Always and Never 20 Truths for a Happy Heart companion journal. So we're actually pulling from both of those today as we're talking about things. But as I was going through them, your book touches on so many different and important thoughts. And I was kind of wondering, how did you decide what kids really need to hear as they're moving out into the world? There are so many things we could be reiterating at this point. How did you pick these 20 things?
Well, the most important thing to me was to give timeless advice. And so that really narrowed down the ideas to universal ones like trust, faith, gratitude, mistakes, love. And so I came up with, I think it was 21 or 22 words like that, and then decided I would frame it up in an always and a never. And I did that because I feel that there are a lot of young adults struggling with boundaries. For some reason, we all heard the phrase never say never. And I really think that was a phrase that was intended to keep opportunity open. It was not a phrase that meant anything goes. And so I do believe there are some definite things you should say never to in your life, because that affects your thinking. And that's really what this is intended to do. Be a resource for your thinking. Once you realize that you're in charge of the way you think about what happens to you, good or bad, the people in your life that you want to be around, how you show up at work every day, that you have control, not the boss, life changes. And so my hope is that these 20 ideas framed up in an always and a never will keep giving you control and make sure that you are the CEO of your mind.
It's funny that you mentioned the never say never, because when I first opened the book, of course, that thought is in my mind. And the first thing I did was to flip through and go, okay, what are the nevers? Like, do I agree that there are things that you would never do? And it did surprise me a little bit that I was going through. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, okay, definitely, never, never, never. I'm good with this idea.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. Because it's never, the nevers really push out limiting thoughts, right? If you never let negativity have the last word, then you will not do what so many people do without realizing it. And that is derail themselves, because they, instead of being resilient, get stuck in that victim mentality of the boss doesn't like me, or, well, I'm just not good at math. You know, those things are limiting ideas. And so never have limiting ideas. Why would you? Keep thinking about the things you can do, how you can get better at them, and your resilience in when things don't go well.
It puts me in mind of, as our kids are younger and as we're raising them and they come up with something, and this idea of, as a parent, I mean, yes, there are things that we said no to, but as they got older, as they got into junior high and high school, a lot of times they would come to us with an idea that I just didn't feel was our responsibility as parents to cover. Or I didn't feel it was our responsibility as parents to change our schedules around enough to make the time for them to do something, when there were certainly ways that they could come up with to do it themselves. And one of the things that we were teaching our girls was, instead of saying, oh, you know, my parents said no, say, okay, that avenue doesn't work. How can I do this? How can I get the money? How can I get transportation? How can I fill in the blank? And that's kind of what I hear you saying there with this never idea, is that there aren't no's until you decide it's a no. And when we decide it's a no is what determines how emotionally healthy and how many opportunities we have in our life.
I agree with you. And I think that was a great tactic for you to teach your daughters, is that sometimes when one road isn't open, look around for the other roads to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. And one of the, I think, best things a parent can do is not make everything so easy, because we know that we want our children to be resourceful, and they need to be even more resourceful when they're living on their own. And if we have figured out every problem for them, then we're not really letting them see what they can do.
I like that. I like that idea. And with the always and never, you talk about them in terms of being mantras. What do you mean by that?
So I think that when we are either in reflection or we are preparing for something, it's good to take a moment to go deep within yourself and just say some positive things that you need to call on for that day. And so maybe you are taking on a new job, a new role, where you're stepping into something you've never done before. So how can you prepare? How can you prepare for stepping into something you've never done before? And you know, fear, it's always so funny as a manager, I'll talk to people about an opportunity and they'll go, well, I've never done that before. And I said, well, that's why it's a promotion, because you're going to be doing something new, but you're ready for it. And they're so afraid of making mistakes. Having a few mantras about the beauty in mistakes, or that you are going to do as you say you were going to do, right? Or you're not going to pretend to know something you don't. And you're going to realize that help is there for you. All you have to do is ask for it. So when you can call on a few mantras like that, it can really help prepare your mind for a new situation. So I think mantras are good as a way to prepare. And I think they're a good everyday practice when you're going on the way in and you just maybe need a little positive reset about going into your day.
I'm chuckling because as I speak to kids, it started around the time my girls were juniors in high school and the kids are thinking about what they want to do post high school, post college, all of that. And I saw the same type of thing that you're talking about is they were just fearful and going, I can't do that. They would get a summer internship and say, I don't know how to do that. I said, they don't expect an intern to know how to do anything.
Right.
They'd be happy if you know how to show up at work on time at the moment. That is your job, is to show up and be willing to learn. Be there, be trustworthy, be honest, be responsible, and learn. That's your job. And I tell them when my first job was actually at one of the big three auto manufacturers. And I tell kids, I'm like, I spent the first 2 months answering phones and saying, I don't know the answer to your question. Let me find out and call you back. And I learned so much in those couple of months that I ended up writing the quality manual and putting it all together in one place. But that's the job, right? And you're talking about kids and mistakes. And I know we have a lot of fear around failure in our culture, which comes back to, oh, I can't make a mistake. What are you seeing about that in our kids right now? Do you see that that is a problem for them?
Yeah. Two things. There are a lot of, you know, kids who are going for perfection, and life is moving way too fast to perfect. It's much more important that you always think of being a student so that you can learn, unlearn, and relearn. Because as soon as you perfect something, it's going to be irrelevant. So I'm very concerned about when I see young people in the job worry too much about perfection. And then as it comes to mistakes, unfortunately, shame is way too much a part of our culture. And of course, I work at the University of Houston, and Brené Brown is an expert on shame, and that is really her space. But when I see people afraid of making mistakes, it is because they don't want to be embarrassed and they think there's a lot of shame with it. And what I'm trying to really inculcate in our culture is we expect you to make mistakes. All you have to do is own it and say, I learned from it, and move on. Every day, that is how you learn, is through mistakes. And that means you've done some stuff. If you've gone through life and not made mistakes, you haven't done anything. But it is a mindset shift for a lot of young people who, I mean, they've been brought up on, and I'm not trying to make any kind of political statement because, of course, there's a place for standardized tests. But since the early years, teachers have been all about preparing people for a test. And just by the word test, it implies pass or fail, right? Mm-hmm. Or how well you're being scored as an individual. And I just read an article over the weekend that in Finland, there's a mandatory 15-minute play break that they evaluate students by their ability to play and interact and have fun and get along as much as they do the learning. And I think now with computer learning the way it is, we're learning so much without even realizing it, reading so much more, taking in so much more information. The social skills are suffering and need to be brought back and need to be taught and supported as much as the book learning, because there is no organization that you can think of right now that is doing well and that is part of our future that doesn't involve projects and group work and group think. There isn't any.
Right. So let me ask you this.
You have to do that.
And this may not, we may not have an answer here. Projects and group work have always been frustrating for kids from the beginning of time. What suggestions do you have for us as parents for helping our kids to get as much as they can from that experience and to really learn from it? You know, some of the common problems, you know, one kid doesn't do what they said they do. Someone else ends up picking up all the slack. One person gets really bossy and won't listen to other people's ideas and absolutely must run the show. And those have some qualities, what happens in a work environment, but it's not the same as in a work environment. You know, it's not an identical thing. So as parents, what can we do for our kids to help them get what they actually need from those group experiences?
I think the most important thing is awareness. So if, as a parent, you all could have kind of an awareness discussion, if us parents had awareness discussions about what it means to be a team, because you can't separate people from their personalities. And if you pull together five people, one person will be that perfectionist driver that just is perfect. They're perfect and they want others to be perfect. And when others aren't, they're going to rush in to pick up the slack. And then you've got people who are like, well, great. If you're going to do it all and I'm not going to be perfect, I'm just going to sit back here. So you have that dynamic at play. Then you also have a situation where, you know, some people's personalities are a little more disruptive and they're not aware of that. And so what does the team do about it? It's always the soft skill stuff. It's never the knowledge. And I really believe that as difficult as it is, if there is a shared understanding of what's involved and everybody knows the pieces, which this is difficult sometimes because it's a dynamic and it's not always so clear. But if early on, there was a project where each person said, hey, I'd like to do this. Or they went outside their comfort zone if they're a numbers person and didn't do the numbers, but had to do the words. As much of everybody could sort of see this as role-playing and less personally invested, the better off we are. Don't be so invested and tied to the outcome as the experience. And that's something we can do as a parent when they're children. In the workplace, the outcome, of course, is important. But it is, I believe, our own innate personalities and who we are when we come to that table that determine it. And we may be contributing to the people who are quote-unquote slackers because we're not really giving them the opportunity to weigh in. We had a conversation about this in the office the other day because some people are just quiet. They're just introverts and they're not going to speak up. And one of the extroverts said, and I'm tired of being patient about you. Either speak up or don't sit back and complain that you aren't involved. And I just kind of smiled to myself because I think the mastery comes when you're able to know that introvert outside of that moment where you're working on the project and be able to find a way for them to feel like they want to speak up. And I know that sounds like a lot of extra effort, and gosh, am I now supposed to say, play psycho, you know, be a psychiatrist at work and a therapist at work? No, you're not. But building relationships is number one. You can't wait till you're on a project to then decide, okay, now I'm going to have a relationship with this person. You can go in the workplace and build relationships cross-departmental, you're going to be successful on any team.
Well, and the introvert extrovert example is very interesting to me. I did some work with Beth Bielow a number of years ago, and she's the introvert entrepreneur. And that experience got me started in understanding more about introverts and extroverts and reading about it a bit, and then doing things differently in my family, in my community groups, in my work. And what was fascinating to me was this example you gave. The extrovert went, I'm tired of being patient with you. Like, my way is the way that's best and that gets the work done. Whereas, as I read about it and I found other ideas, it was like, introverts need time to process something internally to get their best ideas out. So when I started understanding that and sharing that and running things that I was involved in, where we said, hey, you know, let's send out these ideas in an email before we get together. We got such better results because we really were including everybody's best work. You know, introverts would bring these great ideas to the meeting and they would have thought it through. So then as brainstorming starts, there is a lot more give and take and play in the situation. But I think it goes back to some of that idea a little bit, because you talked about, you said, you know, have our kids be invested and tied to the experience more than the outcome, realizing that in the job world, the outcome is going to become more important.
Once again, if we can think about the experience, not be so judgmental of the others, stay focused on what we're trying to do, there can usually be a good outcome. And we're not going to change human nature. But awareness of who we are when we come to that table, awareness of, am I that introvert? Am I that extrovert? Am I that bossy person? Am I that person that is not engaged? I think that is the greatest thing you can give your children, is that when you come to the table, who are you? And that is very much going to define your experience. Because if you can be engaged and optimistic and all in without judging the other people and just, you know, encouraging, you're going to be a leader. You're going to be a leader because people push up performers. You know, we have this idea, and a lot of people, when they enter the workforce, think that the bosses handpick, they look among the crowd and handpick the chosen ones and they are brought up. And actually it is the bosses pick who the crowd is pushing up. Because A, there's somebody people want to work with. B, they can be trusted. Because why? They do what they say they're going to do. C, they have a level of competence that can get it done. And generally speaking, they are positive. They don't gossip. And they represent, you know, the best of the group. So I would also encourage children to be that person other people want to work with. And the bosses will always know who they are.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I think that that idea of being aware of who we are, that is a lot of what your books are doing for our kids. Yes, there are lessons and there are things for them to think about, but especially when you start going into the companion journal and taking each of those 20 ideas and asking questions, that is opening up our children's awareness of who they are, but it's who they are, how they're functioning in the world. I liked it because it wasn't this big, well, who are you? What do you love? Like enormous questions that can shut them down. Your questions were very simplistic, but powerful, I guess, is the way that I see it. And with that, I know that you have said that awareness is important. Right now you said awareness of who we are defines our experience. Do you have other reasons for awareness being so important for our kids, awareness of themselves and who they are and how they show up in the world?
Yes. Other reasons are just your own inner peace and well-being. Because if I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and they were, you know, wishing this and hoping that. And the more we talked, I learned that he had not had a good night's sleep, that he was not feeling well. And I said, you know, given that, your perspective on everything right now isn't clear. Everything is being tainted by the fact that you're tired and you're not feeling well. This is not a good time to do deep thinking or form perceptions that, you know, are going to get cemented in your mind. Get a good night's rest. Wake up tomorrow, you're going to feel. So being aware in that moment, I'm not, you know, life isn't going my way or whatever, is really clouded by the fact that you're physically not feeling well. So that awareness right there is really important. So yes, it's extremely critical to your inner peace is being aware. Again, you're in charge of your thoughts. You can change your thoughts. And by changing your thoughts, you're going to change what you say, and then your actions follow suit. And once you get all of that in alignment, you have that inner peace. And so, yeah, the journal is meant to be an exercise in that. You know, we talk about forgiveness. And a lot of people, when you want to talk about forgiveness, the one they need to really forgive is themselves. And when you realize, you know, what is holding you, what will happen if you forgive yourself? And how does holding a grudge really help you today? Then you get some strategies, you know, for maybe doing that. Physical activity, writing a note, you know, to yourself. Or just be the first to say, I'm sorry. You know, just suck it up and say, I'm sorry. That is like a breath of fresh air. Whether you're apologizing to yourself, something in someone, you know, in your family, friends, or whatever, and then you can move on. And it's so freeing. It's so freeing. And so that's why I wrote the journal. It's really meant to be kind of a quick strategy fix on the way you're thinking so that it opens up new possibilities.
Yeah, you've mentioned a number of times, it's a thread running through this conversation, this idea of that we're in charge of our thoughts. You know, we can be aware of our thoughts, we're in charge of our thoughts, we can change our thoughts. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you have mentioned about the companion journal is that it provides ways for teens to disrupt their negative, mindless routines and take control of their life. Mm-hmm. Is that part of that thought process that we're showing them, making them aware of their thoughts and showing them how they can change them, or is there more to it?
It is, when I say mindless routines, I'm speaking of everything from like and share, all the time spent on whether it's Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and I don't expect anybody to stop doing that. I get it. It's the way we live now. But you can spend hours doing that. And at the end of it, you wind up feeling a little empty. And so what I'm saying is take some of that time and go deep on you and the way you think. And you will be shocked about things that have just become habit. I do spend a good bit of the first part of the journal talking about your media consumption. And I think it's worthy to note that we're talking about 11 hours of our day that we're interacting with media, and that's according to Nielsen. So when's the last time you really stopped and looked at what are you watching, reading, and listening to? And just take a moment and see if that is affecting the way you think. Are you spending a lot of time with violent content? Are you spending time with negative content? Sexually explicit content. I mean, those things are going to affect the way you think and the way you act. And I think, you know, of course, I work for PBS and NPR, and we're all about education and inspiration. And, you know, there's Nova, there's nature, where you can learn about your world. You can go on fantastic learning journeys and really see this big, expansive, all the positive in the world. And so, of course, I really want people to be aware of the content they're consuming and making sure that it is and truly enhancing your life. Life is too short for you not to be intentional about what media you consume.
That is true. And even as you said, also the time.
The time spent, 11 hours, 11 yeah, hours. One. We're only awake, you know, what? 15, 16 hours a day.
Yeah, I have not heard.
11 with media.
I have not heard that 11-hour statistic. That I'm having a hard time even processing and accepting that. It's a little scary. And it's making me think and go, well, am I doing that? How much time am I doing that? And why am I doing it? I mean, certainly many of us are spending more time on screens for work, but then there are other pieces that come into that. But I don't want to go off on a large.
Yeah. Well, you know, time, because your phone has everything on it or your car or whatever. I mean, you're with media. If you're in motion, you don't have to be stationary to not be with media. That's.
You know. Oh, certainly. Yes, right. Absolutely. Yeah. It's in our pockets. You've talked a lot about work. We've talked about things that are happening in the workplace. And I love that you are a proponent of mentors. Mm-hmm. It's certainly something that many of us here in the business environment, whether it's through a company, an organization, or your own business, if you're doing training, you will hear, get a mentor, get a mentor, get a mentor. But you talk about that it's important for teens to have a mentor. Why is it important for a teenager to have a mentor when, you know, they have their parents?
Well, I believe that parents have a limit on what a teenager is willing to receive from us. How many times have you told your daughter something only for them to come home and say your exact words and attribute it to someone else, and now it's something they're willing to listen to, right?
Right.
And so mentors and other people to look up to, and of course, you know, we always have to be careful about who our children are holding up as mentors. But whether it is through their coaches or through church or through an academic club that they're in, people who can see them and see a certain strength or talent they have and spark an interest in them, teachers have that capacity because of what they do. They are life changers for our children. How many astronauts or other successful people, astronauts, I'm from Houston, right, have talked about that teacher that said, well, of course you can do science. And it doesn't matter how many times a parent says, oh, science is the field of the future. You should be a scientist, or some words like that. If a teacher, this person who isn't, you know, didn't give birth to them, it's that third party endorsement idea. And that third party, you know, taking an interest in them that makes them feel like they're going to be relevant outside the household.
So what can we do to help our kids seek out a mentor? It isn't something that always just happens. And we don't want to live our lives just waiting for everything to happen and things to fall into our laps. So what can we share with our kids or encourage our kids to do to create those relationships?
I love the way you started this podcast and you said, ask your child a question. So you could start by saying, hey, who's somebody you think is a role model in your life? Who's somebody that if you could have lunch with, who would you pick? I ask them, get them to start thinking about people they look up to. And then maybe, you know, you can suggest, well, hey, have you ever thought about asking them to have a 15-minute meeting with you? Have you ever thought about, you know, what would you ask them? You know, so you kind of, because kids and their self-confidence are all over the place. So, A, you have to help them think about who a mentor is and what a mentor can do. And again, that mentor is supposed to be encouraging and guiding. It's not a performance coach. Okay, so that's another thing we have to know. A mentor is usually in the industry that you're trying to get into, but in the setting of when they're not in school, it's somebody that is a source of encouragement and guidance, like resources, like pointing them to resources. So if I were mentoring someone's daughter who wanted to be in the media business, I would be talking about internships. I would be talking about writing papers. I would be talking about what kind of role they might want in the future. What cities do they want to live in? What, you see what I'm saying? So it would be that conversation that would have the child start seeing their journey. Or it could be as simple, and mentoring can be very informal. You know, it can be twice a year. But having them, and the reason why I think you start when you're in your teens or in college is because one day you're going to graduate and then you're going to look for a job. And I've written a series of articles about getting that job after college, and it's a team sport. I always talk about get a team around you, not your parents, who will look at your resume, who will do a mock interview with you, who will tell you what to wear, who will give you some guidance on how to answer some maybe tough questions. And then you go back to that team after you put out the resumes and the interviews and you give them feedback, and they keep kind of propelling you forward, because it is difficult and it requires a lot of self-confidence.
Yeah, I like that. And I have seen the power of that. One of my girls just had an amazing experience at her college where the faculty and the staff are, they show up, almost all of them. It seems like that's what they want. They want to mentor these kids. They are on fire about really helping them out. And to see the power of that and how it translated as they brought people in from various industries to work with the kids and to help them out, it changed. It's a real game changer. It truly changes everything, not just the opportunities the kids get, but it changes the kids. Like you said, then they start to see things in themselves that they didn't see before. And to have that start when they're young, and I say young, even if they're little, that's fine. But, you know, to encourage them to start that in their teen years is, I think, a very, very powerful tool for our kids.
Absolutely.
So the themes here, I'm kind of going back and going, all right, this is, to me, a very inspiring conversation, because it's kind of easy ways to help our kids have a better life. And just sharing some of these ideas or working through the books, you know, with them, or one of the things we talk about at Mighty Parenting is modeling behaviors. And I was going through these and working on them for myself. And that's one of those things then is I can start conversations with my kids and say, I was working on this and it was very interesting to me. This is what I noticed. And it then models that introspection. But I love at the beginning you told us that never say never was intended as a saying to help keep opportunities open, not to say that anything goes. And that we don't want limiting beliefs in our life, and using never say never can limit you and limit what happens. So if we let that go and say, yes, there are always and nevers, then we can focus on the most important things, which are universal lessons and things like trust, faith, gratitude, mistakes, and love, and see how we're showing up in the world and show our kids that they are in charge. They are in charge of their life. And when they understand that, then they can change their life. And the idea of helping them learn to be introspective, to help them see how they're showing up in the world, and then they can start looking at, is that how they want to show up? And then this idea of having mentors who find things in our kids that they may or may not see in themselves, or maybe our kids saw, but they encourage it or broaden their horizons. I love these ideas that you shared with us, Lisa. And of course, we will have a link to your book on the show notes at mightyparenting.com. But for anyone who wants to learn more about you or the book, where can they go online to find that out?
They can either go to amazon.com or barnesandnoble.com. And I also have a link to Amazon and Barnes & Noble at my website, which is lisashoemate.com. And I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to be a part of your podcast. I love that you are helping parents. It certainly is not, there's no manual, but your podcast is the closest thing to it. And I just really also want to leave you with the thought of love as our young people are going to be going into their first relationships, that they realize that unconditional love is really the only way to love, but you should never lose yourself to it. And the right out of college and in those years are really a time to find yourself first. And then you can define what it means to love later, unconditional love, and how many important relationships you will have besides that love relationship in your life and how important they are. So thank you so much for this opportunity. And I wish your daughters the very best, and anyone who's listening, who is going through parenting, I wish you the best, and may you always remember the joy that it is to be able to be called mom or dad.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been a pleasure having this conversation. And Mighty Parents, thank you for joining us today and being part of the Mighty Parenting community. Remember to go to mightyparenting.com to see what else we have for you beyond the podcast. And I will see you next week.